Welcome into the WVED studios. This is Blue Hen Sports Cage, 2 hours of sports talk radio on the way. Our top stories from around the world of sports. The Los Angeles Dodgers continue to dominate the major leagues. The Dodgers are on an 11-game winning streak and have won 31 of their last 35 games, currently comfortably ahead of the National League West. And that's your top story.
Speaking of Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Lakers have taken the Summer League title. It doesn't mean much, but without Lonzo Ball, still get it done. Lonzo Ball also winning the Summer League MVP. Things looking up for the Lakers.
We have a lot to get to on the show today, Ahmed. Covering a lot of ground across a lot of different sports, and we're going to begin with some pretty serious news that came out this afternoon pertaining to O.J. Simpson, not a name that we're talking about every week here on the show, probably the first time we've mentioned him, but it's kind of swept across all the major sports networks, so we thought we'd at least give it the top billing here on the show. O.J. Simpson today was granted his release from his Nevada prison and will be out on parole within the next few months. It's anticipated that he'll be released sometime in the beginning of October. He served about 9 years of a 33-year sentence for stealing sports memorabilia in Las Vegas. Obviously, not the only crime that he's been associated with throughout his past. In 1995, he was acquitted of murder charges to both his wife and to her love affair. And then in 1997, he lost a civil case pertaining to that same incident. But this is the first time that he was incarcerated. But after 9 years, he will be released on parole. Ahmed, your first reactions to this news?
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting because you were saying it in their pre-show meetings how we're just, you know, a bunch of kids from the 90s, mid-90s, late 90s. So what exactly this means for us. But talking about OJ, obviously, because of his football career, really, and how everything ties into that and into the world of entertainment with Robert Kardashian, his famous lawyer. So all of this is very interesting. You said he served currently 8 out of 33 years. Is that correct?
Close to nine.
And that's really interesting because he did get the maximum charges. We were talking about how if any other person, this is a large or hefty fine, a parole initially or something of that nature. But for him to get 33 years is interesting. But I guess it was kind of expected by the lawyers, the people, the jury, whatever, and anyone involved in this. So it's interesting to see how this all works out. And he will be released in 2 months or something.
Beginning of October.
So interesting to see a lot of mixed reactions from people. And like you said, 70 years old now, and he's going to still have the rest of his life to, you know, I guess do whatever he wants now. And people have mixed reactions and mixed feelings about this. But I guess just as younger kids in this generation, this is really weird to see and kind of see how both of his crimes, can't really say he was guilty of that one, but kind of wrote his book about his that love affair that happened and if he were to kill someone, how he would do it. So to tie all this together, it's crazy to kind of bring it up 7-8 years later to see exactly where we are now.
I think a lot of people will be surprised that looking at this guy who, in many people's eyes, murdered two people, having him serve just 9 years in prison throughout his whole lifetime, and now, as you said, Ahmed, being 70 years old and having, 15 years, maybe 20 years to continue his life while people argue that the people that he killed, unbeknownst to them, can't continue out what they had planned for themselves in their life and their family can't be there with them. But at the same time, I think people who looked at this from the legal side saw a person who only had this memorabilia crime against him. So if he followed through with what he needed to do while he was in prison, which it seemed like he did based off what happened in the hearing, then he was going to be released early from that 33-year sentence. And again, that sentence also pretty harsh for the crime that it was associated with, but maybe trying to make up a little bit for what didn't happen to him in the past before that. Obviously, like Ahmed said, I was born in 1997. His murder trial was in 1995. I think a lot of our listeners
The year I was born.
We'll have a lot more perspective on this, having lived through the Bronco chase and everything like that. So there's plenty of coverage out there if you want to learn more about this and about
great
all the
documentaries
details
out there as well.
Absolutely. The O.J. Made in America, 30 for 30.
Excellent.
I've tried to watch that twice. I fell asleep both times during it. Not to say it's not good, but it's not the best thing to watch at midnight.
It's not the fastest moving documentary.
Yeah, it's about 8 or 9 hours long in total.
Few parts.
But if you want more information about this, it's out there. wanted to give Teddy the week off. He's down on the Outer Banks trying to enjoy some sunshine. But this week, a lot is going on with his Washington area teams, so we thought it would be good to bring Teddy in and have him explain everything that's been going on in the D.C. area. Teddy, how's it going down there?
Well, I, of course, wanted to get some time off, as you mentioned, but you know what? You can never rest because things do happen, and we got some baseball to talk about. We got some football to talk about. It is gorgeous down here. I know you had your beach week last week, but able to find a few spare moments here and there, and excited for the show tonight. I know you guys got a lot of good stuff on the agenda.
We're going to start with your quarterback in Washington, Kirk Cousins. The franchise tag deadline passed on Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern, and Cousins and the Redskins did not come to terms on an extension, so Cousins will be playing under the franchise tag this season. He will earn $23.9 million. It's his second straight season playing under the tag. Was this expected, Teddy? Were you surprised that Kirk Cousins and the Redskins did not come to terms on an extension?
No, I don't think it was surprising based on everything that has happened over the last several months and what appeared to be the inability between two sides to figure out this agreement. And so when we came to the deadline the other day and it passed 4 p.m., nothing happened. The news that the team did not sign him to a long-term deal was not surprising. What was surprising is the events that followed after that in a whole dramatic situation. But overall, Kirk Cousins has done a really nice job for his team ever since getting drafted behind Robert Griffin III. A lot of people thought that he was left out to dry being drafted in the later round, a really good quarterback in Michigan State. And he set a number of franchise records, and maybe a poor throw in Week 17 against the New York Giants last season let the doubt come into a number of people's minds. But the guy's been really good, and should he have an extension at this point? Absolutely. But is it surprising that he didn't get it? No, and most of that stems from the fact that the Redskins' ownership has been real poor at communicating with him and his agent. So when you look at the specific numbers, they offered him 5 years, and they say $53 million guaranteed. Now, Bruce Allen, the Redskins' president, says that those numbers would make him the second highest player in the NFL. But to crunch numbers for a little bit, I don't want to bore you with them, but Cousins' 2017 salary this season is going to be $23.9 million. And let's say, for example, they put him on, they use the transitional tag on him next season, which would be $28.7 million. That total is $52.6 million, which is just slightly under the guaranteed money. So when you look at it in that perspective, the guaranteed money that he was offered is very similar to what he would be making anyways. So it's not an impressive contract offer, which is mainly the reason why, at this point, Kirk Cousins said, you know what, we need some more time, and I'm going to play this year out, see what happens. We've got a lot of other guys who are going to become free agents, and it will be another year under the franchise tag.
Just to dive deeper into those numbers for a quick second, you mentioned the transition tag, which would, again, pay him $28.7 million next year, but would leave him susceptible to signing with another team. The Redskins would then get to match a contract offer if he came back to them with one from another team. If they want to outright control him next year on the franchise tag, that's $34.5 million. And then, like you were getting to, Teddy, that's more than the guaranteed money that they offered him in the five-year contract extension. And even then, it's not 100% certain that that contract came to the table, and the team president, he thinks the guy's name is Kirk Cousins, not Kirk Cousins, so there's some problems beyond just the numbers. Is there any way for Kirk Cousins and the Redskins to come together throughout this season and reach a contract extension at the end of this year? Is there any scenario where, you know, we've gone through this 2 years now, that at the end of this coming season they come to an agreement on an extension?
Well, you mentioned the president, Bruce Allen, calling him Kirk Cousins, K-U-R-T, as opposed to his real name, K-I-R-K.
Right.
And Kirk Cousins says, you know what, I wasn't bothered by that. Just very professional response, even though his general manager, Bruce Allen, a lot of people speculating, he doesn't really know what he's doing with that. But back to your question, sorry for the diversion. I think it's highly unlikely at this point because Kirk Cousins has said, you know, I'm going to play this season out, and then we will talk when we have that window in the early portion of 2018, whenever the season ends, early February after the Super Bowl, when they have that window to exclusively talk between player and franchise, and that's when they will do it. I think it's very unlikely that they'll talk this season. They've had the opportunity to do that the previous season, and you saw that it went absolutely nowhere. There's a lot of hesitation here by the team thinking that he's not the guy. And not to bore you with the whole backstory here, but I do think a little bit of it is valuable in that it was Mike Shanahan who wanted Kirk Cousins. It was Mike Shanahan who drafted Kirk Cousins, seeing the potential in him. And Mike Shanahan did not make the decision to trade for the number two pick to draft Robert Griffin III. That was something that was more mandated from the ownership and management. So you see Dan Snyder getting involved there. Mike Shanahan wanted Kirk Cousins. Now Mike Shanahan is gone, and Dan Snyder hasn't wanted Kirk Cousins around for the most part, and he controls the franchise. We see it like what goes on in Cleveland with Dan Gilbert. Some of these owners, they breathe in and they control everything that happens in their franchise. And that immediate back from 2012 concern over whether this guy was going to be a quality NFL quarterback has left the doubt in the Redskins ownership mind. So when you look at it that way, you kind of feel bad for him because this is a guy who got drafted by a certain coach and he set record on record on record for your team. And now he's got a coach in Jay Gruden who actually does work well with him, and that has done well. But then again, his offensive coordinator, Sean McVay, is now the head coach of the Los Angeles Rams. So there's a lot of other moving pieces here. And I just don't know if Dan Snyder and Bruce Allen see this guy as their long-term quarterback. And I'm sure we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. Who is the answer long-term if it's not him? That you can start speculating, but there is no answer long-term. So if it's not this guy, who is it? And that's what a lot of Redskins fans have been asking themselves.
Ahmed, as an objective observer of the NFL, one, is Kirk Cousins a quarterback that you can build a franchise around? And two, if he is, where does he rank among the top quarterbacks in the league? Is he in the elite category? Is he an above average quarterback? Where do you think he, how do you think he compares to the quarterbacks who are getting paid this similar money to him?
Well, first of all, I really became a Kirk Cousins fan last
Kurt
year.
Kurt or Kirk?
Kirk. It sounds like a T, but I'm saying Kirk, trust me. but yeah, I am a Kirk Cousins fan. Became one last year, just kind of a fan of his game. He doesn't do anything exceptionally well, but he's a overall great player. The money, I think he deserved a long contract, and I know that there was, you know, two sides of that story, and they offered him something, he wanted one thing, or, you know, he's holding out for the future, wherever his future lands. But when you use the word elite, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but I'm thinking top seven or top eight, maybe even, and I think he falls just outside of that. I do think though Kirk Cousins is a top 10 quarterback in this league. But as far as money goes, I know contracts are different for everyone. I mean, we just saw Steph Curry just get paid now while he was making, you know, under $12 million for the majority of his career. So you can't really get too caught up in the money, in the dollar signs. I do think he deserves that money. But as far as elite goes, I think he falls just outside of that. I'll put him at number 9 or number 10.
Teddy, same question to you. Where does Kirk Cousins fall among the NFL's best quarterbacks, and should he be the long-term answer in Washington?
He's probably right outside the top 10. I wouldn't call him elite myself. Ahmed kind of explained that. I don't know if he's elite, but you can look around the NFL right now in general, and there are very few teams that have elite quarterbacks. And for some teams, it takes several years for you to look at your quarterback as elite. I don't think many people looked at Matt Ryan as an elite quarterback before this past season when he brought his team to the Super Bowl. So for some players, you grow with time and you improve with time, and then for them are stars right out the back. But I just don't think that he can be considered elite. With that all being said, though, without a doubt, he's the best option they have at the moment. And if you get rid of him or you don't have him, you are getting worse, because he is your best option, and there's not a better option right now. Is there a better option in the future? Well, that's where you have to talk to the scouts and figure out who do they see coming out of college in the next couple of years. But, and I saw something on Twitter the other day, a joke about, you know, Jay Cutler is going to end up in Washington. That there's kind of three avenues here. It's either Kirk Cousins with a long-term deal. Well, I'll give you four options. It's Cousins with a long-term deal, option one. Option two, they keep giving him increased numbers in money for a franchise tag or transitional tag every single year, which seems completely ridiculous now that they've done it for 2 years. And that's the first time that's happened in NFL history. So it would be rare to see that continue to happen. The long-term deal, they keep tagging him. Option three, he goes and they draft somebody young and you start fresh. And option four, he goes and you bring in some veteran like a Jay Cutler or a Brian Hoyer. I don't even know where to begin with those names. But, I mean, you look around and you say, yeah, by far this is the best option we have. And a deal should have got done, ideally, a year ago.
And maybe if you want to replace him, the most wise thing to do would be bring in option B while he's still there. Look at what the Kansas City Chiefs did this offseason. They have Alex Smith, maybe a small step down from Kirk Cousins, but a good quarterback in this league, a quarterback that a lot of teams would like to have, but they draft Patrick Mahomes in the first round, and now they have that future option. We'll have to keep looking at this Kirk Cousins situation all throughout the next season, as we have for each of the last 2 years, but it's possible he could be on his way out of Washington after next season. Now we are welcoming Jake Lampert on the phone from New York. Jake, a big weekend in tennis, and soon the tennis world will be up there in New York with you at the U.S. Open. But first, we need to cover what just went down at Wimbledon last Sunday, I believe. Roger Federer winning his 8th Wimbledon and his 19th major. I'm just going to start off with this question, Jake. Is Roger Federer the greatest tennis player of all time?
I don't think there can be any doubt that says he is not the greatest tennis player of all time. I think he is. I mean, he has 19 Grand Slam victories, 8, like you said, at Wimbledon, and 5 Australian in the U.S., and he has 1 French victory. It's tough to say that anyone is better and will be better than Roger Federer. He didn't even drop a set in his Wimbledon victory. He was the first male player since 1976 to do that. I don't think there's any consideration that anyone can bring up besides maybe somebody like Nadal or Djokovic to even fight that, or Sampras. But I do think Roger Federer is the greatest of all time.
Any surprise there, Jake? You did mention he didn't drop a set. He won 6-3, 6-1, 6-4 a little too easy, and then we saw a little bit of a mental breakdown there by Cilic. What'd you make of that game specifically?
Not that I was expecting something like that, but Federer, before this tournament, took almost about a 6-month break from tennis. For lack of a better word, break. He played a couple exhibitions here and there. Cilic, I think, had 17 matches in between the 17 big matches in between the Australian and Wimbledon, which takes a huge toll. And then to go from somebody like in the quarterfinals, Cilic played Mueller. In semifinals, he played Sam Querrey, which was one of, I think, the best matches at Wimbledon, beating him going 6-7, 6-4, 7-6, and 7-5. It takes a lot out of your body, playing matches against Mueller, Querrey, and even Steve Johnson in third round, who's always kind of a thorn in the big player's side, working them 3-4 sets. It wasn't really a surprise to see Cilic go down with an injury. I think it was deserving, knowing how hard he's worked and how fresh Federer has been. But I don't really see it as an excuse. He fought through it, which Federer was very open to, saying he did a great job trying to fight through his injury. But it was almost as if once Federer stepped on the court, you kind of knew it was his match to lose.
This season has really been a renaissance of some of the players that dominated this sport just a few years ago. But, you know, we kind of all maybe left for dead, or at least thought we're on the decline. And Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal. Federer won the Australian Open to begin the year, as you mentioned before, after that 6-month layoff last year. And then Nadal comes out and wins French, as he's done 10 times. Federer comes back and wins Wimbledon. What do you make of this group of, you know, the big four, as they might call them, this group of dominant tennis players that are in the all-time discussions, that have all played in the same era, and yet, you know, just continue to dominate the sport? The quote-unquote big four, which is Roger Federer, Rafa Nadal, Novak Djokovic, and Andy Murray, have won 45 of the last 50 majors. These four players, and even if you want to break that down to just the top three, Djokovic, Nadal, and Federer, have absolutely dominated this sport for the last 10 years or so. what do you make of this era of historical excellence from these players?
It's great for the sport. At the same time, it's a little dry for the sport. It's great for the purpose that you know that whenever you see any of these top four players step on the court, you're going to see greatness. You're going to see the almost nonchalant play of Federer as he never seems phased on anything. You're going to see the energy of people like Nadal and Murray who just can pull games out of nowhere when it seems like their back's against the wall. They just walk over their opponent. And you see the kind of grace of Djokovic, what he's always been known to do, is just be so smooth and so clean with all of his shots that it almost seems like he's been doing this. Well, he has been doing this for his whole life, but it seems like he's been doing this for seven lives before that. But it's also kind of dry for the sport in the sense that you know you're just going to see one of these four players winning. Like you said, 45, I think the number is, out of 50, like you said. I think the biggest thing is that, like you said, we are seeing greatness. We are seeing the four of the best tennis players to ever touch the court. You know when they go up against each other. Somebody on ESPN put it as, these four players are the gods, and the only way to take down a god is with another god. So their only loss is the big matches we saw between Nadal and Federer and the big matches we see against Djokovic and Murray when they meet each other. I think it's overall great for the sport to see four great players, and not even just them. You have players like Cilic and Wawrinka who are very good and always seem to fight hard against these top four players. You have other people that can make a headline name, but it is tough to beat four players that you know you're going to land on in your quarterfinals, in your semifinals. It's tough for them, but it is great for the overall sport of tennis.
That was my next question, Jake. How good would a player, how many championships could a player like Stan Wawrinka or Marin Cilic or a couple years ago Ferrer and Juan Martín Del Potro, if they were playing against the typical competition where maybe there's one superstar and a couple other really talented players and then the pack, how many championships could these guys win but they haven't won because they're going up against the big four?
It's a really interesting question to think about, because if the big four wasn't the big four, you'd have like Nadal, even Kyrgios, even Jack Sock, players that are just every time playing against, I mean, the last, I think, two tournaments that Fed played in before this, he's faced Kyrgios in either the semis or the quarterfinals. Kyrgios has run into him so many times, just has not been able to beat him. It's something that I think has to have gone through their mind at least once, like, oh, what if these big guys weren't here? How many can I win? But they're still fighting. They're still good players, and it's not that the big four are immortal. They can be taken down. I mean, Sam Querrey played an incredible match. That is the best match of Wimbledon against Andy Murray. It was unbelievable to watch. He's a player, one of the best serves on the men's side. He is going to keep playing hard and keep having opportunities to win. So I don't think it's how many could these players win if they weren't there, because they're just going to run into other good players. It's not going to be like, oh, they're just going to walk through to the finals. But I do think it's a lot more knowing that these guys aren't here, and you can have your Wawrinkas, your Querreys, your Kyrgios is just walking towards the finals. So to answer the question, after I went a little off track here, I do think it's a lot more possible for those players when they don't have to run into brick walls like the Nadals, the Djokovics, the Murrays, and the Federers.
Left-handed pitcher Jose Quintana going across Chicago from the White Sox to the Cubs in exchange for outfield prospect Eloy Jimenez, who is ranked the number 5 prospect in baseball by ESPN's Keith Law, and Dylan Cease, who is their top pitching prospects, and two other infield prospects. In his first start as a member of the Chicago Cubs, Quintana went 7 innings pitched and struck out 12 batters. He struggled a little bit earlier this season, but what do you think of the pickup of Jose Quintana for the Cubs?
I mean, look at his first debut, 7 innings pitched, 12 strikeouts, 0 earned runs. I mean, the rich just get richer here. The reigning champs picked up a great starter in their rotation, and right now they're on a 6-0 win streak coming off a road trip. They're looking to really head down there and just make a great second-half push. I mean, they didn't really give up much in just Eloy Jimenez, just Dylan Cease, Matt Rose, just some minor position players that weren't really huge prospects in order to get that big-name starter.
I think it was good that they didn't have to give up the current MLB youngsters like a Wilson Contreras or a Javier Baez, which was talked about because Quintana is maybe the most valuable piece that was out there on this market because he's controllable not only next year, but he has 2 team options for the years after that. So let's say the asking price was Wilson Contreras plus 2 or 3 of those prospects. Would you still have done that trade, or would you have only done it for these minor leaguers if you're the Cubs?
Man, that's a tough decision because Quintana, especially, like, just to help him in the rotation, because John Lester has been falling off a little bit. Like, he allowed 12 runs in, like, in the first inning, like, the first time in, like, 100 years or something. Like,
yeah.
But I think you still got to pull the trigger for the Cubs, just because you need something to change in the clubhouse after the just horrible first half start, and just after this All-Star game, they're obviously heating up right now. So, yeah, I think you do it.
And maybe it's not just Quintana's on-field contributions, but just the fact that we got somebody. Like, let's go. Let's win this division. We're still the Cubs, even though we had that bad first half of the year. While we're still on the Cubs, do you think there's any more moves that they need to do? They had a little injury scare yesterday. Chris Bryant left the game early, but he looks like he'll be back in a few days. The pitching, you add Quintana, but you mentioned Lester's still struggling. Arrieta's still struggling. Is there any other place where you could see them making a deal before the deadline?
Maybe a deal in the bullpen.
Yeah.
Again, maybe they'll make an offer to Oakland for Sonny Gray and maybe give up those prospects that they were able to hold on to. But I think the Cubs right now are winning and they're making a good push. And I think that's just what really changed Chicago around just in general the past couple of years. Their management just stepping in and getting some big field names, star names to help their prospects grow, like Chris Bryant and all of them, and just really help develop them, and just some veteran experience. And I think Quintana brings that and will help the Cubs make a playoff push.
They're just a game back of the Milwaukee Brewers in the Central. That'll be definitely a team to watch, because if you're a playoff team, even though they might come in at 84 wins, I don't think you want to play the Cubs in the playoffs.
Oh, not at all, especially with their offense.
You're listening to Blue Hen Sports Cage on 91.3 WVUD. We're talking MLB trade deadline. Already moves underway, and we're still 11 days from the deadline. A big move, maybe the biggest bat on the trade block, was J.D. Martinez. He gets traded from the Detroit Tigers to the Arizona Diamondbacks in exchange for 3 infield prospects highlighted by Dewell Lugo, but he's just ranked the 4th prospect in Arizona's system, not in baseball. So not a whole lot in the prospect department, but the Diamondbacks are able to pull in J.D. Martinez.
One of my favorite pickups and trades. I'm happy the Diamondbacks pulled the trigger and made the move just because they needed another offensive weapon in there, as their outfielders and just their hitting in general have only hit about 200 or to the mid-200s, batting like 250 all around.
Yeah.
And J.D. Martinez just the hottest hitter right now in free agency and just the best hitter, batting 300 and absolutely destroying left-handed pitchers at 500. Just a great offensive weapon, especially to go along with Paul Goldschmidt, and I think it's just a great move for Diamondbacks, especially just because they have, I didn't think they need to go anything with their starting rotation or bullpen because their pitching staff is just unbelievable right now.
Yeah, Greinke and Robbie Ray, the 2 All-Stars.
Oh, yeah.
And the bullpen's really good too. You mentioned that him hitting lefties. This morning I looked up his OPS against left-handed pitching, albeit in a smaller sample size because he had an early season injury, is way over 1, like 1.2. So he's crushing lefties.
Oh, yeah.
And to hit 300, you still got to be hitting okay against righties. So he's a big bat. He's not a great in the field, but I don't think that's too big a concern for them because they do have some of the like lighter hitting, better defensive outfielders. So is there any concern with this fielding, or do you think this is just a total win?
There's definitely some concern with the defensive part of his abilities, but they're really outshined by his bat, like being able to put the ball in play, especially batting at 300. Diamondbacks, you got to take the chance on that, and you got to just deal with his outfield play.
Currently, the D-backs are 11 games back in the division, but they are half game up for the first wild card spot. So I don't think anybody's catching the Dodgers this year. They're fighting to keep that wild card spot, and that would still be an improvement for them because, you know, haven't been to the playoffs in maybe a decade, a long time for them.
Oh, yeah, especially
so
when
they're all in.
Especially when nobody really saw them, like, improving much, like, this year or had them in the running at all. I don't think, like, from the MLB experts, I didn't really see any mention of the Diamondbacks in the playoff scenario.
Right, because they think, okay, Dodgers and Giants out west, and they had that pretty disastrous Shelby Miller trade a couple years ago.
Yeah.
So they're like, all right, we got to keep building for that. But Robbie Ray breaks out. Paul Goldschmidt is like the forgotten MVP of the National League year after year. So they have some pieces there, and I think Martinez is another big one to add. Big move in the Bronx. David Robertson, Todd Frazier, and Tommy Conlin go to the Yankees for Tyler Clippard, Blake Rutherford, who was their first-round pick last year, and two more prospects. But three pieces, two relief pitchers, both righties, and Robertson and Conlin, and Todd Frazier, who a few years ago won the Home Run Derby, he's been an All-Star before, go to New York, who's in the battle for the wild card and the battle for the American League East, and they make a big splash. What do you think of this move?
As a Mets fan, it pains me to say, but the Yankees made the best trade so far out of anyone. Picking up Todd Frazier, just an incredible offensive hitter and just a great third baseman, while also just drastically improving their bullpen, especially because their bullpen has been inconsistent in Adam Warren, even Chapman, and then also like Chad Green in there. I just hate it. I just envy it because I wish the Mets got Todd Frazier. But it was also cool because Todd Frazier, that photo from 1996, standing next to Derek Jeter as a kid after winning his Little League World Series, and now he's a Yankee, I mean, just shows you how everything comes around.
Frazier is hitting just .206 entering play today, but I think that's been a little highlighted too much. He's getting on base at .326 clip, and he has 16 home runs, which is something that the Yankees need offensively. This season, I think a record like 46 or 47% of runs have been scored via the home run. So if you don't have that power in the middle of the lineup, there aren't many guys just circling the bases, stealing bases as much. It's a record year for home runs. So even if Todd Frazier, I think, is at .210, I think he's a valuable pickup if he's hitting 25, 30 home runs, and they don't have Greg Bird for the rest of the year, so they make a move there. And then they added this bullpen. Robertson, Chapman, Dellin Betances, Tommy Conlin, who I didn't really even know before this trade, but his ERA is 2.5, and he's striking out, I think it's 15 strikeouts per 9 innings pitched. And then Adam Warren struggled a little bit, Chad Green struggled a little bit, but they're still solid pitchers. You have three, maybe four all-star quality relievers in that bullpen. How is Joe Girardi going to utilize that, and how much of a weapon is that, especially when we get to October?
Well, it's going to be a huge weapon in October because then you'll be able to manage guys and just have plenty of options, just give guys rest, just being able to check their pitch counts and then have reliable guys on hand for you. But Joe Girardi shouldn't have a problem unless injuries start to pile up. I mean, injuries happen. That's the only obstacle in my mind that can get in their way of the great bullpen they have right now that can really make them a huge threat in the AL East.
Traditionally, if you have a flamethrower in the bullpen, you make him your closer. He pitches the ninth inning. He gets three outs. But last playoff season, we saw Andrew Miller come in fifth inning, sixth inning, pitch two or three innings at a time, get out players in high-leverage situations, and really carry the pitching staff of the Cleveland Indians. And then we even saw the Cubs doing that a little bit in the World Series with Aroldis Chapman. But now I think you can kind of do both things. I think you can have the closer, and you can have a guy come in the fifth inning and strike three batters out and get your starting pitcher out of a jam. Buster only called Dellin Betances this morning their exterminator. If there's a jam in the beginning of the game, you just put Dellin Betances on the mound and have him get you out of it, and then in the 6th, 7th, 8th inning, you still can go David Robertson, Warren, and Chapman and shut people down. You can make it a 6 or 7 inning game, but you can also have the flexibility to get out of jam. So I think come playoff time, they could revolutionize how you use relieve pitchers over again, just as the Indians kind of did so with Andrew Miller, and on the other end of that, the Baltimore Orioles failed to do that with Zach Britton. They had him sit the bench in that extra inning game that they lost the first playoff game, and they didn't put him in there where they probably could have used the guy in a high leverage situation. But I think the Yankees will kind of be be able to straddle both and do both things there. So those are the three big trades, Quintana, Martinez, and then the Robertson-Frazier-Conley trade to the Yankees. We asked Teddy earlier about his Nationals move. That was the fourth trade, an earlier one, with Sean Doolittle and Ryan Madsen going to the Nats and prospects going back to the Oakland A's. Just quick thoughts. We did go through it with Teddy, but your thoughts on that move, Nick?
Nats won the deal easily. Landed a pair of quality relievers who possess excellent ball control without giving up any of their best prospects. I mean, on the other hand, the law writes that the rebuilding A's cleared salary also got back a capable big league reliever in Trinian and a couple of promising young players, but the Nats easily won this deal without giving a whole lot in exchange.
So moving forward, we still have 11 days until the trade deadline, despite these moves going down, and some more names on the block. You mentioned Sonny Gray earlier. I want to ask you about the top two teams in the National League and the American League, the Dodgers and the Astros, who are both in similar situations. They're both dominating right now. The Dodgers are 11 games up in their division, and the Astros, despite losing Carlos Correa the other night, are 15.5 games up in their division. Do either of these teams need to make a move, or should they make a move?
I want so badly for the Houston Astros just to make the move. I really want them to make a playoff push, and I want to see them go deep into the playoffs just because, like, after so many years of them being bad.
Right.
But I think they need to definitely add some extra help in their bullpen, especially with Dallas Keuchel being hurt, Colin McHugh, just getting a rotation starter like Sonny Gray, who's the best available pitcher right now, and then just picking up Justin Wilson from the Tigers. I wish they decided to pull the trigger and, like, made the deal with the White Sox in exchange for David Robinson. Not so much Todd Frazier, but...
Yeah, I don't think they need Todd Frazier. They
don't,
they got enough bats.
It wouldn't help to have a bat like Todd Frazier.
Yeah.
But just the relief help. I really would like to see them pull the trigger. And the same goes for just the Dodgers. They just could really do... with a nice left-handed hitter, because they've been getting just demolished by right-handed pitchers and just have not done good in itself against lefties. So I think they definitely need help in that department just to get another left-handed hitter in the lineup and just get more people on base in that aspect.
I want to start in my response to the Astros. One, when they lost Correa, my first thought was get an infielder. Like, don't let this lead slip away. The Angels and Mariners are capable teams behind you. I know it's 15.5 games, but you never know. Like, the Mets in 2007 probably felt really comfortable with that 8.5 game lead or whatever it was, and in the last week of the season that evaporates. So you never know. Get somebody to right the ship, just like a rental guy for like a couple single-A pitchers. But then you look at their depth chart, and they have this guy Marwin Gonzalez who can play anywhere, and he's hitting 300 with 15 home runs. And you look at the depth chart, he's plugged in at short, or you could put him at third and Bregman, their third baseman, at short, and they're set. So offensively, I agree. I don't think they need anything there. I don't think you can have enough relief pitching. Chris Devinsky and Kenny Giles had good first halves of the season, but they're both getting hit a little bit more. I think if they did add Justin Wilson, or I'll throw out Brad Hand from the Padres, another guy who could be on the market, if they add a reliever, I think that only helps them come playoff time, have another eighth, ninth inning arm. So that's where I stand with the Astros. And with the Dodgers, I agree. It's crazy that last year they were talking about how they couldn't hit left-handed pitching, and now they have Justin Turner hitting over 400 against lefties, Logan Forsyth, and this guy Chris Taylor, who's playing in left field while Adrian Gonzalez is hurt because Cody Bellinger is playing first. And they're all mashing against lefties, but they could maybe use a bat to use against righties, a lefty bat. And then I think relief pitching, you could always use another reliever. Like, they have Kenley Jansen, but if you put one of those arms with Kenley Jansen, now it's a 7-inning game. And you have Clayton Kershaw, so he pitches a complete game, and now you have options for day two in the series. But I think both of those teams are in a good spot. And I'll pose this question for both of them. They both have good young prospects. How do you balance competing this year and making your team absolute best that it can be this year and keeping that long-term future intact? Because I don't think they need to make a move, either of them, but they could get better. How do you balance that future with trying to win this year? Because they both have a long-term future. They both have really young, talented players, Correa, Seager, so forth.
again, like what we were talking about before, but making minor deals to where you give some of your lower prospects up in exchange for not a bigger names, but like a Justin Wilson, someone who will get the job done, who has experience and who has is available right now, who can give you those innings that you might need down the stretch, especially in the playoffs. You can't have enough pitching, especially for the Dodgers or Astros in this situation. But you also can't put that much of an emphasis on all your prospects. You just have to be willing to wiggle around and move them around also, especially because right now your teams are playing at their absolute best. I mean, the NL West is just back and forth. It's crazy. But if you're the Dodgers, it's win now.
Put this hypothetical question on our rundown. I don't know if we can spend that much time on it. It's kind of a big question, but just to get your brief thoughts, should the Orioles put Manny Machado on the trading block at the deadline?
Nah, because Manny Machado is just a player you build around. He's one of the best third basemen, if not the best third baseman in all of baseball. The guy can hit, but I think they might have other players that they can put up instead, like Adam Jones or Zach Britton, someone that they can get prospects for in exchange to help build their future along with Machado.
They're 7.5 back of the division, but just 3.5 back of the wild card. I think the case for trading him would be, if we can't sign him 1.5 years from now, let's get something for him before he walks, but maybe it's a little premature for those talks. I don't think that they're going to put him on the block, but something that's kind of come up in the last couple of days is should they be looking to move him. And you look across town, Boston has that opening at third base and a young prospect in Rafael Devers, who's one of the best in baseball. Do you try to get Devers and some from Machado right now while he's still under contract? But at the same time, you get into that argument of, well, don't you want Rafael Devers to turn into Manny Machado? And you already have Manny Machado, so why not lock him in there? But that's something for the Orioles to think about, because they are 3.5 games back of the wild card, but I think a team that most people have kind of written off at this point for the playoffs. Still a New York Knicks, but things have changed in New York. Steve Mills is now the new team president. He was already part of the front office, but he's elevated to the role of president. And Scott Perry has been acquired, you could say, from the Kings to be the general manager, the number two in command. Team president is the role that is often associated with what a GM kind of used to be, and the GM is that number two, at least in basketball. So they have a new front office, but Carmelo Anthony is still a Knick. And they've been talking to the Houston Rockets about trying to get a trade done, but so far to no avail. Ahmed, what do you think is going to go on with Melo?
So you did mention Scott Perry. Last week, some talks have been going on. They've been trying to retain Melo in New York. Long story short, it hasn't been working. He's not down for that. He's not a big fan of that idea. Melo is going to be leaving. The question is just when. And I believe the front-running team is Houston. In my professional opinion, he will sign with Houston. Again, it's just a matter of when that will happen. I know the talks are ongoing. They're long. They're strenuous. The pieces have to be made because Melo is very, very open to waiving that no trade clause. That's really what New York has, you know, that bind, how they have him. So Melo will be leaving New York. We'll figure out when. Hopefully it's very soon. I hate to talk about this. It's kind of dragging out now. Also, another team into the mix, Melo to Portland. It could possibly happen. CJ McCollum had a quote on him yesterday how that this team would be completely different and very much improved. That's debatable. I don't know what you think about that, Brandon. But Lillard also trying to sell Melo on that. I don't know if Portland Trailblazers will be able to acquire him. But again, just another team in the mix just to make things interesting.
I think Melo makes them better, but I don't know what the Trailblazers can give up.
I can't pick up his quote yet, but he said something about how they would be significantly improved.
I think they would be.
Significantly, though?
What significantly? Are you saying like
that? 8 seed to 7 seed, that's it. That's not significant.
True.
Does he think they're going to win?
Then they're better, but they're not significantly better. I don't think
they're not going to get home court in the playoffs.
Them, Yeah, it doesn't make them a top four team. It doesn't make
Not
them better
all.
Than OKC or Houston or San Antonio or certainly Golden State. But it makes them better. I mean, it's better than having Crabbe and Evan Turner as your third option. But what are they going to, I mean, are they going to give up Evan Turner for Melo? Is
no.
that something that the Knicks want?
Yeah, and you're looking at a lot of first, you know, number one first round picks. That's what you're looking at. But I'm looking at your notes right now, Brandon. What needs to happen? Let's stick to Houston. I can't think of a scenario because I know he's going to land in Houston. I don't know why. I just, you know.
You said that like 3 months ago.
Yeah, I did say that, and it's making me look dumb because it's not happening, and it should happen very, very soon. But, you know, I'm trying to look into my magic eight ball here, but, like, what? Who needs to go? What needs to happen? And I can't figure it out, and I'm looking at scenarios, and I'm like the crazy guy in your room with, you know, the map
on.
And, you know pinpoints here and all over, lines everywhere, and you're trying to figure out who goes, who comes, who comes here, who leaves, but I can't figure it out. Do you agree? I think he's going to Houston.
Yeah.
Going to Houston.
I think at the end of the day he will, well, not the end of today, but so to speak. I think what needs to happen is the Rockets will either relent on their willingness to trade Eric Gordon or Trevor Ariza for him. They'll either give up one of those guys and do the swap straight up, or they'll find a third team that's interested in Ryan Anderson, and that's the guy that they've been wanting to give the Knicks. They'll trade Anderson to another team for picks or young players, and then send those assets to the Knicks for Melo and Melo to Houston. But the team that's getting Ryan Anderson probably wants to give up a contract of their own, so then now are we talking about a fourth team or another contract going to the Knicks? It's very complicated. But the Rockets are in a place now where to get Melo, they need to get rid of either Ryan Anderson, Eric Gordon, or Trevor Ariza, and they want to keep Gordon and Ariza, and the Knicks want Gordon or Ariza. So it's a cat-and-mouse game of who's going to blink first,
yeah.
Or can something crazy happen where the Knicks can get something that they want and the Rockets also get rid of Ryan Anderson. I don't think that'll happen. I think they'll more likely to give up Eric Gordon for him,
mm-hmm.
because I think Eric Gordon and Melo are more similar players than Ariza. I think Ariza gives you more defensively, which you'll need
yeah.
with having Harden and Melo on the same team. But they would
Great
really like to
player.
Give up Ryan Anderson. And if they give up Ryan Anderson and bring in Melo, I think that makes them better.
Mm-hmm.
If they give up Gordon and bring in Melo, I think they're a little bit better, but I don't think they're significantly better.
I still like retaining Eric Gordon, but again, also looking at the Knicks' perspective, I think they're also trying to give up Joakim Noah, so he's possibly on the move. So I like what you said, though. You got to involve some teams here. I think that's what the problem is. I think it's the Knicks and the Rockets unable to do a deal, so they need to do a better job of involving some more teams and possibly even Derrick Rose.
Because I think the Cleveland-Melo trade thing, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. It was a second team, which, from reports, that's the second team he wanted to go to.
And Portland is a little bit interesting, but Melo has a no trade clause. Does he want to even play in Portland, and can Portland actually make that deal happen? I think those two things are unlikely. So I think he ends up in Houston eventually. But, I mean, this could drag on for another month or two. I don't see anything happening immediately.
Derrick Rose deal, I think, will get done before this.
You said you had some breaking news on D-Rose.
It's not breaking news, but it is developing, I guess.
Right.
Is it, you kind of downgrade it from,
sure.
like, the news factor.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
You can't call everything breaking
news. Not everything
news.
Is breaking news or fake news, but...
We don't do fake news.
Yeah, we don't do fake news here. Chicago is also in the mix, looking for a little bit of a reunion. A couple people are interested in that. I don't know how I feel about that. They played with
my
emotions way too much.
I think you got to leave that door closed.
It's like a roller coaster of emotions.
I don't think he makes you better enough that you put your fan base through that and you bring him back. He was so beloved by the city of Cleveland for that little spurt where he was the MVP. And then the
City
injuries,
of Chicago.
Excuse me, yes. And then the injuries
Hometown
hit
kid.
One after another.
Yeah.
And like it toys. I mean, as a Sixers fan, you know what the injury bug can do to you. Watching Embiid on the sideline for 2 years, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
So to bring him back into Chicago and him being half the player he once was,
yeah.
I think that would just be frustrating for everybody involved.
It's like running back to your ex multiple times. So I think they need to avoid that. He also met with the Lakers today.
The Lakers and talks with the Cavaliers earlier this week.
Interesting. He's definitely, I would say, more of an upgrade than Deron Williams and LeBron. I know we weren't going to get into that, but LeBron unhappy in Cleveland, so I think Cleveland still needs to do something. I think Derrick Rose is a good pickup.
They brought in Jose Calderon to be a backup point guard. Is Derrick Rose a significant upgrade from Calderon?
Not significant, but an upgrade.
Is he, like, he'd be worthwhile? To
yeah, I think so. Kyle Larona, I think he was a, what, a 44% shooter, a three-point shooter. So he's a guy who can shoot the ball, but what does he bring defensively? What does he bring as a leader, as a team, a player, a veteran? I don't know if he brings too much. I still, like, still saw flashes of excellence and flashes of old D. Rose. So I think that there's still some left in the tank. But again, I think he's a guy, if you can convince him to come off the bench or something or be a role player.
Well, he'd have to come off the bench.
Yeah, if he's okay with being a part of, you know, a top 10, top 12 roster, wherever he might lay within that, I think then he's fine, yeah.
If he plays with LeBron, do you think he'll get a big bump in his numbers like some of the other veterans we've seen play with LeBron? Think of a Shane Battier. Richard Jefferson. Do you think... Yeah. He could go back
James
to
Jones?
Averaging 15 points, 12 points a game and being really efficient?
No, I think he can go back to maybe, you know, 10 points, you know, 4 rebounds, 3 assists. I think he can go to an efficient role player.
But like being a, you know, a solid role player.
Yes, I think LeBron can, you know, revitalize his career to a certain extent. Again, he's not his doctor, so he can't fix his knees. But he can help him a little bit. I think Derrick Rose will be of some use to Ty Lue and the Cleveland Cavaliers.
And flipping that the other way, does that make LeBron happy to have Derrick Rose?
It makes him happier because they haven't done crap all offseason. So, yeah, it makes him happier. It doesn't make LeBron happy, though.
Both LeBron and Kyrie, as we were slightly referring to with these talks, voiced through different leaks and ways through the media over the past week that they weren't happy with what went on in Cleveland's offseason. Mm-hmm. The Cavs still don't have a general manager or a president of basketball ops. And the offseason, as we talked about earlier on the show, is over. Like, all the top names are off the board.
Yeah.
I think they missed the boat on Paul George. They probably missed the boat on trying to get Carmelo Anthony, if that's something that they wanted to do.
Now you're in an awkward situation with Kevin Love now, too. Like, do you guys want me? Do you not want me? Am I going to leave again next year?
And is LeBron James going to leave after next year? Because then the team is blown up. It's over if LeBron leaves.
Mm-hmm. Kyrie also
a lot of unanswered questions, and Kyrie
his contract is he's a restricted free agent next year, I think.
Yeah,
so he could, you know, possibly exercise and get paid if he wants to.
See what happens.
A lot going on.
There's a lot to think about with the Cleveland Cavaliers. We could go on for two more.
I'll end it on this. They've stayed the same, and in the NBA, where everybody's getting better, if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. And I think that's what happened with the Cleveland Cavaliers, and LeBron knows that.